Moorhead Carroll in the podcast Find It. Today I have the incredible opportunity of talking with one of the King of England's chaplains. Her name is the Reverend Susanna Gunner. So we want to get to know you a little bit, and then we want to talk about spiritual wellness. I've been telling you a little bit about how we're contemplating a center for well-being or a center for wellness, and of course at the heart of all of that is your spiritual life. But why don't we begin by getting to know you? How did you come to be curious about God and start studying about religion? Why? How did that happen in your life?
Well, I had two parents. And my dad was a priest, and he had gone to King's College London to read theology when he came out of the army. Army because it was just post-war, so everybody went into the forces for some of the time. And he'd also trained at St. Martin's College of Art, which I think is another bit of the jigsaw that is me, probably. Anyway, so he was a priest, a trained priest, and my mum was a very bright lady, I think, looking back. Neither of them is alive or has been alive at all. In fact, neither of them know I'm ordained. Well, maybe they do. I don't know. Who knows? But faith and the turn of the liturgical year was just part of my life growing up. I absolutely loved the turn of the liturgical year and the way it changed, the colours and the things we did and the foods we ate. And my mum and I used to come out of church every day dissecting my father's sermons, poor man. So it was there from a very early age. And then I went to Durham University, first of all to read classics. That's what I thought I was going to read, Greek and Latin. But in fact, I found myself in a college where everybody was eating and breathing and sleeping theology, and I just caught the bug. I wanted to do it too, and so I changed course at the end of my first year, and it was fantastic already to have Greek, classical Greek, which is much harder than New Testament Greek, so it was very easy for me to carry on in that way.
So it was really part of your DNA then. It wasn't
absolutely
everything, any, you were just seeped in it. You didn't choose it. It was part of your fabric of your upbringing, but also art. Now you'll see when Susanna preaches later, she always, well, I don't know always, but
often
incorporates visual art into her sermons. So you'll see her do that when you hear her preach next. So no wonder you had art as also woven into that part of it. Tell us about when you began to be cognizant of praying on your own. So not just church and the liturgical life, but when you chose to say, you know, hello God, oh, I'm here, you're here, something like that.
Well, again, actually, I think it was when I was very little. I can remember aged 8 running home from church, just skipping along the road, along these little country lanes, saying over and over, Jesus, Jesus. So I'm afraid it was right at the very beginning. But then there were gaps, and I guess in any life there are bound to be peaks and troughs. And
yes.
I actually found it quite tricky when I first went to Durham, because it was a rather conservative evangelical college by tradition. And this was a whole new type of Christian faith for me. So, but I really value that I had to tussle with that and really think about it. And then actually, I think I was a teacher first, and I think teaching faith, whether it was Christianity or Judaism or Islam or Hinduism, makes you really think about it. You've really got to internalize it if you're going to teach it well. And I really value my many years as a teacher and all that children and young people taught me.
I want to pause for just a minute, because you said something very insightful that I believe is important as we're talking about spiritual wellness. You talked about highs and lows, pits and troughs, you said. I think that Americans in particular, we tend to think about progressive improvement. We're supposed to be getting better all the time, but that's not really how the spiritual life works, is it? It's not quite something we can control or make into a linear progression.
No.
Could you elaborate on that a little more?
Well, I think, well, one of the things I value most of all is paying attention, this sense of being really open to, well, open to God in beauty and love and pain and everything, really. And I think in a human life, we touched on it yesterday in quite a, well, more than touched on it, we dealt quite significantly with the fact that every single one of us is a bit broken in a way. And because things happen, life, stuff happens in life, and we are scarred. But so that can easily bring us down, but also it can be a launch pad for understanding things in a new way, and we emerge from it a bit like a butterfly from a chrysalis with a new flutter in our wings as we move forward. I just think it really goes like that, and we may emerge slightly differently with different priorities and valuing different sorts of a different take on things, or imagining that poetry is wonderful for our spiritual life, or I don't know, things like that.
So you would say in spiritual development, we often encounter, we'll go along and encounter something hard, something that we struggle with, but that's part of the journey, and that's actually how we grow, is through that struggle. So it's not so much things get better progressively if you keep saying your prayers.
No.
But there will be things to wrestle with.
Yeah, it gets better when we keep being human and become more and more human, more deeply humanized by God's, by letting God's Spirit humanize and tenderize us.
So tell us, you're a teacher, and then what happened that you became a priest? How did that happen? Mm. And it was, when you were ordained, it was a little bit later. How old were you when you were?
I was 50 when I was ordained. I was a late ordinand, I guess. But in England, it's only been possible for women to be ordained as priests for 30 years. So when that happened, I was a fully fledged teacher and really loving my teaching. And one of the things that I did, as well as teaching in an ordinary classroom, was to become the education officer at St. Albans Cathedral. And my job there was to work with the tens of thousands of school children and older students who came to visit the cathedral every year, and help them to interpret the cathedral in all sorts of different ways. So we used it as a classroom for every subject across the curriculum, apart from physical education. I never managed that. Mm-hmm. But the great thing was that I had a wonderful team of teachers and volunteers, 5 paid staff and 40 volunteers, who welcomed the children and worked with them in really imaginative ways, and got them to really, we didn't have clipboards and filling in the answers on a piece of paper. I wanted the children to be looking up and out and really be changed by the fantastic spaces around them and what those spaces spoke of. So I did that for another 12 years, and it was really only after that I came to a bit of a stop, and I thought, I think I've done this for long enough. And then other people started saying, well, have you thought about? So I eventually decided that I would honour their intuition and discernment and see and test that call. So that's how it happened.
So people bothered you enough that you
they
finally
did.
Agreed?
Yeah, they bothered me.
Tell us what it's like to be a chaplain to the king. How many are there? How does that work?
Okay, so be prepared to be disappointed, my dear friends. There are 30 king's chaplains, so 30. And I don't actually know. I ought to investigate a bit more. I was appointed as a Queen's chaplain first in 2020. So it was right at the beginning of the pandemic, which meant that I never met the Queen. I feel really sad about that, because initially all the times that I might have met her, the rug was pulled because of COVID. They didn't happen. And then on the occasion I might have met her in 2022, she was too frail. And so that never happened. Very great sadness, because I admired her deeply. But I'm expecting to meet King Charles this May, in fact, next week, at a garden party at Buckingham Palace. Probably sounds like something out of a storybook to you. But I am actually going to Buckingham Palace. But the downside of being a king's chaplain and going to a garden party is that you have to wear a thick red cassock. I mean, what girl wants to go to a garden party in a cassock? So Ben will come with me and we'll have a nice time, I'm sure. And I will meet King Charles then. And
a couple of translation words. So for those of you who don't know, not know, a cassock is a black robe. We just have black ones in this country, I think.
Yes, but king's chaplains wear a scarlet one.
Wow, that's going to be hot.
It is.
And Ben is her husband.
Yeah.
When she says she's bringing Ben, that's her husband. Yeah. Who is here with you somewhere.
Yes, he is. He'll be at the 10:30 service. So it's and I have to preach, all the chaplains preach once a year at the Chapel Royal in St. James's Palace. But really that's the only task, apart from praying, of course, for the king. Mostly it's an honour. It's an acknowledgement of, I don't know what in my case, but it's just saying, well done, thou good and faithful servant. That's basically what it's doing.
Well, and tell us about King Charles. So you know a little bit about him then and his personality.
I do.
We don't know him very well. Do you like him all right?
Yes, I do like him. I respect him deeply. He's been around all my life because he's older than me. Not by very much, but yeah, he is quite a lot older than me. I respect him because he is thoughtful. And he is very knowledgeable and takes his role incredibly seriously. If any of you watched the coronation, whenever that was it last year just? Oh, yes, last year. You will know that service, to serve, was a theme that was very, very dominant in that occasion. He is entirely committed, as his mother was, to serving not just the people of Great Britain, but the Commonwealth and creation itself. He led the way in many ways on highlighting the vulnerability of the natural world. And he was ridiculed for it at the beginning. People thought he was, you know, a bit cuckoo, but in fact, he has been completely vindicated and is very, very knowledgeable about it, and is a deeply spiritual man, takes his faith very seriously.
Now, Susanna, one of the themes that you worked with yesterday that I would love for you to elaborate on has to do with the natural world. How do you see our spiritual life as being a bit like a garden? How is that more helpful to us than thinking of a computer program or a curriculum to learn or something like that? How is our spiritual development an organic process?
Well, because I, as we've touched on already, it has its winters and its springs. It has its ups and its downs, and it needs to be taken care of. We need to, as we said yesterday, we need to pay very great attention to caring for the garden of our world, the garden of creation. But we also need to take great care of our own inner gardens, and of course the inner gardens of each other, which are completely tied up with how our inner garden is. If I'm feeling all sort of stroppy, then that's not going to do your inner garden very much good. So we need to care for them. And you're going to ask me next how to care for them, probably, are you?
Well, I was, as you were talking, I was thinking about the parable of the seeds and the sower. And I've always been fascinated. I always thought we should call it the parable of the soil, because it's really about differing soil, isn't it? The rocky soil and the soil with thorns and the what? How could we have good soil? What can we do to care for our inner spiritual life? What are some of the things that might? And I know it's different person to person. But what are some of the consistent things that we might look to as we try to have rich soil for God to grow some stuff in our heart?
Yeah. Well, I think silence is a really significant ingredient for good soil. I don't know if you came across Sister Wendy Beckett. Did she come across the pond? She was a nun and a great interpreter of art, and she wrote about it a lot. Anyway, one of the things she said about silence, and she lived a very silent life as a hermit, really, in the garden of her convent. She said that those of us who don't seek silence run a very great risk of leading impoverished lives. It was very strong. She felt that it wasn't just an optional extra, that seeking out silence was absolutely vital for us all. So I'd say silence.
That's a wonderful beginning. I like to think of it as when you are not silent, you're skimming the surface of life, running around, staying busy, being on your iPhone, but there's a depth to life's existence and awareness that you can't access without that that quiet. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I would. But I also think that if you do access silence, as you know, and just take that at face value, then sometimes when the world is giddy around you and spinning and you've got 10 things to do before breakfast, you can keep that inner silence going. It's a bit like a wheel. If you think about a huge wheel going round, all the spokes go round, but the inner hub remains absolutely still. That doesn't move. And if we can be a bit like that, that would be so wonderful. And I'm glad my husband's not here, because he would tell you that I'm not like that very often. But that's the thing to which we can all aspire, to have that still, small, silent center holding us fast and keeping us where we want to be kept.
How would you begin to introduce silence into your life if you had nothing but rush?
I think I'd suggest that somebody who had never sought silence before thought about where they can be silent. There is no rule about where it has to be. It doesn't have to be in a church. It doesn't have to be at 6 o'clock in the morning in your own little space. It might be when you're walking your dog, or it might be when you're chopping an onion for supper. But you need to be intentional about it. It doesn't just happen. But I think you can just be intentional about where it is. If you've got a life that can't fit any more in it, then while you're changing your child's nappies or your grandchild's nappies or whatever, that, you know, you can do it there. You can find God there, because God is everywhere.
Mm. So it's really a matter of
awakening and being and paying attention.
Yes.
Like Moses. So he was just about doing his own stuff with his herd of sheep on Mount Horeb, probably thinking, when can I stop for a break? And suddenly something catches him out of the corner of his eye. And then the writer of the book Exodus says that he said to himself, I must stop and look at this great sight. So he is paying attention enough and is cognizant enough of the way God works to know that he's got to stop and look and turn aside, and that's when he sees this great bush, whatever it was. I often think when I'm out walking, gosh, I must turn aside and look at this blossom, or look at this leaf, or listen to this bird, or whatever it is. So we need to take time to stop and turn aside, even if we're chopping the onion, to look at it in its beauty, or to really smell it.
You were mentioning it, that King Charles is so passionate about how we treat the natural world. Isn't that somehow connected to this kind of awareness, that that when we see what beautiful things God has done, that we will start interacting with them in a different way?
Absolutely. And I think not only will we see their beauty, but we'll see their vulnerability and really love them with a, I'm finding that as I get and it might be as I get older, but I think it's more that as I'm becoming more distressed about the apparent inability of global leaders to really seize the moment and do anything extreme and urgent, that I really feel more more tender and more aware and more loving towards, and more deeply appreciative of the natural world that's around me. And it doesn't, you don't need, I mean, you're all, well, perhaps you don't all live in a city, but many of you live in a city where concrete is mostly on the ground. But I passed, as I walked up from the hotel this morning, I passed some wonderful sparrows in the hedge. It's everywhere if you just have eyes to look, I think. We all need to look a bit more.
Talking about eyes to look, tell us about art and how art feeds you spiritually. How does art relate to your prayer life? How do you do that? Do you just every day go and look at museums? How do you incorporate art into your life? You have access to all these wonderful paintings.
Yeah, I'm not sure I do it every day, but certainly when I'm preparing material for other people, that's when it happens for me. That's the great gift of having to preach or having to teach, that encounter happens in the preparation, and it's a wonderful gift to have that time as part of your work. How does that feed me? Well, it mostly I use it as a way of enriching my understanding of the biblical word of scripture. I think words can often get in the way. I don't mean scriptural words per se, but theological words, words in commentaries, words that people use to try and explain something. And people mean different things by the same word, which is where confusion and even conflict can happen. But when we have an image that is fresh to us all, then we're all absolutely on an even playing field somehow. And we see things, and it touches us, as music does too, and poetry, beneath the sort of explanatory X equals Y words. I don't know if I've explained that very well, but it gets to a part of us deeper, I think, than words often get.
Would you say the same is true of music and visual art?
Yes, absolutely.
Are they different in how they reach us? Or does it depend on the person? Perhaps?
Maybe it does. I don't think it does for me. I mean, for me, it's music, actually. We haven't done very much of that, but Bach takes me to God more quickly than anything else.
How would a person find the right time in which to find that silence? How would they go about looking at the landscape of their life and saying, oh, I could, or should they just be listening along the way? And
And well, I mean, listening along the way is great, but if you have got time and you are prepared to carve out time, then you just need to work out what the best time of the day is for you. For lots of people, it's first thing in the morning, but that doesn't work for everybody. If you're not great in the mornings, don't try it. You don't have to be something that you're not. You just need to be more of who you are.
That's a great comment. I love that. We talked last week about physical wellness, which boiled down a lot of it was just get up and move.
Yeah.
The prayer life is kind of just sit still.
Yes.
Or just watch.
Well, just
very
watch.
Simple messages, aren't
watch.
They?
Watch or just listen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just being attentive, paying attention, using the senses that we've been given to absorb God in as many different ways as possible. And of course, what I haven't mentioned is God in the other person. I have a study, a very tiny little study that looks out over a 1960s car park. It is not beautiful, but I see so many beautiful things in it, so many human encounters that stop me in my tracks as I'm typing away. So I see maybe there's a woman in our town who's tiny, diminutive woman, and she's got an adult daughter who is significantly disabled and in a wheelchair and much bigger than she is. And often I see her come back, wheel her daughter back to the car park and lift up the enormous boot of her car and pull out a ramp and push her daughter up, and it's so touching and so loving. She does it all so beautifully that it softens me. That's God talking to me, tenderizing me. Don't make me cry.
So we can see God not only in the natural world, but we can see God in the acts of love and kindness that appear to us.
Of course, everywhere. Gosh, look at you. I'm seeing God in you now.
Yeah.
So absorbed and engaged.
We do have the best view as priests in church. We get to see the face of Christ. They look at the stained glass. What is your favorite part about being a priest now that you are one?
That's a good question.
You can have more than one answer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've always taught and preached. Because I was, I had a lay preaching role in the church before I was ordained. So I've done that for a long time. So it has to be the sacramental. I love baptizing babies. It's an enormous honor to stand at an altar and break bread and then to put that bread into hungry hands that are open like little birds wanting to be fed. I'm doing quite a lot of funerals at the moment, and I find great fulfillment in that, in doing that really well, trying to do that really well.
And I know we're going to wrap up and let people talk amongst themselves, but if someone does find that taste of silence or awareness, how does that eventually help us find out who we are? Can you connect the dots a little bit for us on how does that lead us into our vocation or help us find out why God has made us?
Well, I think if you're silent, you are quiet. Although actually, having said that, it's very difficult to still one's mind, which is, you know, it takes a long time because I wake up with a list forming in my head of all the things I've got to do that day. So that list needs to be put in its place for a while, or whatever it is that's going on for you, concern about something or some physical discomfort or whatever it is. But listening, being sort of open to whatever, open to God, then you're much readier to being nudged in a particular direction, to see an opening, perhaps. I'd like to say something else about prayer in general. I mean, being silent is praying in my book, and being silent and open and attentive is praying. But there are other sorts of praying, and if you asked somebody in the street what they meant by prayer, it would be much more likely to be some sort of request. And we all, we're going to be having intercessory prayer in the service in a moment, when we pray for the world and for other people and for peace and for those that are grieving and those that have died, etc. But one thing I'm really feel very strongly about is that sort of prayer is not about changing God's mind. It's not about twisting God's arm. It's much more about changing us so that we become more ready vessels of what needs to be done to usher in the kingdom in all its fullness. So when people say one for me, they think, you know, they're clocking up some little brownie points. I don't know if you probably don't say that here, but you're clocking up little digits of favor with God or something like that. I don't think that's how it is at all. There's the goodness, the love that is at the heart, the heartbeat of creation, which is God. It's somehow plugging into that intercessory prayer and holding whoever it is in that love and letting them be absolutely enfolded and bathed in it and washed in it and healed in it, and then moving on to the next person, something like that.
Yeah, there are stages of requests. There's the request where we say, God, I want you to do this and fix that. And then over time, as we hopefully age and become a little mature, we start saying, God, I want you to do this, but you might have a better idea. And then eventually we might get to the place where we say, you know, God, you better, I don't know what you ought to do, but please do something.
And here is that person.
And here is that person.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I sometimes do, and I've suggested to other people, and I think they've quite liked it, is to take something from the Gospels that is very familiar. For instance, Jesus healing the paralyzed man. You remember that wonderful story in Matthew and Luke where his friends bring him on a stretcher, and because there's so many people milling around, they can't get at Jesus, so they go up on the roof and they let him down. Well, that's a wonderful story to use imaginatively as you pray for somebody. You can pray, in your imagination, you can be one of those friends taking the person you've got in your mind that needs God's healing to Jesus, and having to get up on the roof and letting them down slowly, bit by bit, by bit, by bit, by bit, until they're actually at Jesus' feet, and then letting Jesus look at them and love them into wellness.
So presenting someone before Jesus so that they can rest in his presence.
Yes, yes.
It's like we're trying to be silent in his presence,
yes,
in the first place.
Yeah.
But using a story like that, I think which we all know, it's helping ourselves somehow. It's something we can actually do in our
That's helpful.
Praying.
That's helpful. Well, why don't we give her a round of applause?
Thank you for joining me in the podcast, Find It. Remember that if you keep searching for the divine presence, you will find it. I want to invite you, if you're interested in hearing more of these podcasts, to subscribe. Just hit the subscribe button and you will be informed of new episodes. And before we part ways, I pray that God will bless you and hold you, give you peace.